Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
And good morning, everybody. This is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call in Singapore, ready to bring you your hour of cheer and good news. And in that vein, I think we should start on this 11th day of May 2012 with a particularly scary rant by Nigel Farage. You really can't do better than this.
Well, happy Schuman Day, or Europe Day, as you now call it, although I thought the celebrations were rather muted. The only bit of real passion we had was Mr. Schultz slagging off the English, but that now appears to be the sort of popular sport in this Parliament. And when people stand up and talk about the great success that the EU has been, I'm not sure anybody saying it really believes it themselves anymore. I think we're celebrating the wrong day. We shouldn't be celebrating the 9th of May. We should be celebrating the 8th of May, Victory in Europe Day. We should celebrate the last time the Germans tried to smash the continent and they foundered, and at least half the continent got its democracy back. What we're celebrating on the 9th of May is another attempt, through different means, to smash democracy across Europe. I don't doubt for a minute that Jean Monnet was well-intentioned at the start. He thought that if you abolish nation-states, you would stop there ever being another war. He didn't at the time, of course, have the benefit of seeing that theory as it played out in Yugoslavia. But like communism, this has all gone badly wrong. And the EU Titanic has now hit the iceberg. It is a European Union of economic failure, of mass unemployment, of low growth. But worst of all, it's an EU with the economic prison of the euro. And this now poses huge dangers to the continent. We face the prospect of mass civil unrest, possibly even revolution, in some countries that are being driven into total and utter desperation. But there is perhaps an opportunity, there is perhaps some good news, that now a democratic rebellion has begun. It began in Finland last year with the True Finns getting nearly 20% of the vote. And we're seeing in country after country new political movements on the right and the left making big scores. But that may not all be good news, because in Greece what we saw last Sunday was rather reminiscent of the German election of 1932. We saw the status quo centre collapse and the extremes of right and left rise. You know, this project could even cause the rebirth of national socialism in Europe. We are headed the wrong way. We must break up the Eurozone. We must set those Mediterranean countries free. We must try to build a Europe. I want a Europe, but a Europe based on trade. A Europe based on cooperation, a Europe based on us sitting round the table and agreeing sensible rules on crime and the environment. We can do all of those things, but we cannot do it if we're asked to rally behind that flag. I owe no allegiance to that flag, and nor to most of the people in Europe either.
Well, things are getting hot, as you can see, ladies and gentlemen, and it's being emphasized from all parts of the continent. None is more strident than another, and it's very serious. You know, in response to a request by Spiegel, the German news magazine, the German government has for the first time released hundreds of pages of documents from 1994 to 1998 on the introduction of the euro and the inclusion of Italy in the eurozone. They include reports from the German embassy in Rome, internal government memos and letters, and handwritten minutes of the Chancellor's meetings. And the documents prove what was only assumed until now. Italy should never have been accepted into the common currency zone. The decision to invite it to join was based almost exclusively on political considerations at the expense of economic criteria. It also created a precedent for a much bigger mistake 2 years later, namely Greece's acceptance into the eurozone. Instead of waiting until the economic requirements for a common currency had been met, Kohl wanted to demonstrate that Germany, even after its reunification, remained profoundly European in its orientation. He even referred to the new currency as, quote, a bit of a peace guarantee, end of quote. What the article doesn't say is that Kohl probably had no choice because of Belgium. Here's how it was explained 2 years ago. Eventually, ERM became the euro, with the euro's treaty terms being set in Maastricht in 1992. The problem at the time was Belgium. See, the Germans wanted the Belgian in on the currency union. A core of the Benelux states of Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, along with France and Germany, would have suited the Germans just fine. But the Belgians had a huge amount of debt, over 100% of GDP. That was a problem, particularly because it allowed the unstable Italians an entree into Euroland. The Germans looked at the Italian lira as a soft currency and wanted no part of a currency union with the Italians. The Italians seemed to have a different governing coalition almost every year. They were completely incapable of reining in spending and had a weak currency as a result. However, Italy was a founding member of the EU. So once you let the Belgians in with their huge debt to GDP burdens, you had to let the Italians in too. And once you let the Italians in, well, you had to let in the Spaniards, Portuguese, Greeks, and pretty much everyone else. So here's the grim reality. The euro was a political construct right from the start. The way it began was made for crisis. The euro was designed to fail because monetary union was not enhanced by enough fiscal and political union. Some of the euro's designers, like Italian Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa, often considered a founding father of the euro, knew this. They allowed the single currency to come to form in its present incomplete form for political reasons, as the Kohl documents attest. They believed that the eurozone would develop the necessary institutions to prevent an existential crisis. But they were wrong. Well, have you ever heard the expression, marriage is sweeter than divorce? The euro might be a good case in point. When the monetary union was formed, it benefited from a multi-year period of explanation and benchmarking. So when the euro actually was introduced, there were few surprises. The masses had had time to become accustomed to its value across the zone, the same in all adopting countries, obviously, and price adjustment in everything from retail prices to cross-border loans was relatively smooth. There was some confusion, but overall there was a feeling of optimism. Divorce will be rather different. It cannot be managed over an extended period because the owners of cash assets will not cut the authorities any slack. They'll either rush to withdraw every physical euro possible, or they'll probably storm the Bastille if the authorities impose a bank holiday. And you can forget about cross-border loans. Expect decades of court action and a plethora of defaults by euro-abandoning debtors. And intra-company transfer pricing? I believe we see a new chapter in cost accounting, where somehow all costs are in euros and all revenues in drachma, for everyone from BMW to French wine exporters. What about goods in transit? Did I say I would pay in euros? You must have misunderstood me. And our new government forces us to use the official drachma rate, not the black market rate. So sorry. Even within a country, it will be a mess. The greengrocer will adjust his prices faster than an HTV bot as the new local currency tumbles against the euro. Did I say 200 drachmas? For special friends of Mr. Spiras, we have a special rate, 700 drachmas. We've seen this play out before. Once the proles in a pig's country see what's going on in, for example, Greece, they will do two things. Borrow whatever they can in euros from a non-domestic bank. Pigs corporates, by the way, are already doing this and will continue to do so. And they will just assume they can repay in pesetas or whatever. And they will withdraw every euro they have at domestic banks. The EU may decide to cut Greece loose and regroup to try to support Spain and Portugal immediately, and with all the firepower they can muster. Greece will serve as the example of what awaits those who don't behave and believe. One might think this would be euro positive, and perhaps it could be, but the primary holder of existing and now senior unsubordinated Greek sovereign debt, the ECB, will have to print an amount of euros sufficient to recapitalize itself and its 40-to-1 leveraged balance sheet. It's going to cost an awful lot of ink and electrons. There are many eurobanks which still own haircut Greek sovereign debt, the largest non-Greek banks being BNP Paribas, Dexia, Commerzbank, Societe Generale, Deutsche Bank, Intesa Sanpaolo, and Royal Bank of Scotland. These will also need immediate capital injections. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no easy way out. None. Well, the recent elections in France and in Greece have thrown the global financial system into some degree of turmoil. Fear and worry are everywhere, and nobody really knows what's going to happen next. All of the financial deals that Greece has made over the past few years may be null and void. Nobody's going to know until a new government's formed, and at this point it looks like that's not going to happen, and there will need to be new elections in June. All the financial deals that France has made over the past few years may be null and void as well. The new French president, François Hollande, seems determined to take France on a path away from what they euphemistically call austerity. But France cannot afford to keep spending money it doesn't have. France has already lost its AAA credit rating, and French bond yields have started to move up towards dangerous territory. And Greek politicians are delusional if they think they have any other choice than austerity. Without European bailout money, which they won't get if they don't honor their current agreements, nobody's going to want to lend any money to Greece. And all of this talk about austerity is kind of silly anyway. There never has been any real fiscal austerity. It isn't as if either France or Greece was going to have a balanced budget any time soon. Both nations were still running up huge amounts of debt, even under the so-called austerity budgets. But the citizens of both nations have sent a clear message that they are not going to tolerate even a slowdown in government spending. They want to go back to the debt-fueled fake prosperity of the last several decades, even if it makes their long-term financial problems a lot worse. Unfortunately, as I mentioned before, Greece doesn't have that option. Without the bailout money that they are scheduled to get, Greece doesn't have a prayer of avoiding a disorderly default. private investors would have to be insane to lend Greece money if the bailout deal falls apart. And frankly, even if it doesn't. Greece desperately needs the help of the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. And the only way they are going to get it is if they abide by the terms and of the agreements that have already been reached. The only way that Greece could avoid austerity at this point would be to leave the euro. Nobody would want to lend money to Greece under that scenario either. But Greece could choose to print huge amounts of their own national currency if it wanted to. The situation is different in France. Investors are still willing to lend to France at reasonable interest rates. But if France chooses to run up huge amounts of additional debt at some point, they will end up just like Greece. What's even more important in the short term is the crumbling of the French-German alliance on European fiscal matters. Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy were a united front, but now Merkel and Hollande are likely to butt heads at every turn. So you see, instead of moving in one clear direction, the Eurozone is now fractured and tensions are rising. Investors are not clear what comes next, and that has many of them deeply concerned. Just to give you an idea of what people are saying, listen to a few of these quotes. Tres Knipper of Kenai Capital Management. What is going on in Europe is an absolute disaster. The risk on trade is not the place to be. I want to be out of equities and very, very defensive because the situation in Europe just got worse after those elections. End of quote. Mark McCormick, currency strategist at Brown Brothers Harriman, and I quote, we're going to have higher tensions, more uncertainty, and most likely a weaker euro, end of quote. Nick Stamenkovich, investment strategist at RIA Capital Management in Edinburgh, quote, investors are questioning whether Greece will be part of the single currency at the end of this year, end of quote. Jörg Asmussen, a European Central Bank Executive Board member, quote, Greece needs to be aware that there is no alternative to the agreed reform program if it wants to remain a member of the Eurozone, end of quote. Tristan Cooper, sovereign debt analyst at Fidelity Worldwide Investment, I quote, a Greek Eurozone exit is on the cards, although the probability and timing of such an event is uncertain. Art Kashid. Here's the outlook on Greece from Wall Street watering holes. If a coalition government is formed or looks to be formed, global markets may rally. Any coalition is unlikely to make progress on goals since austerity is political suicide. There will likely be another election around June the 10th to 17th. A workable majority or plurality remains unlikely, so back to square one. Therefore, Greece will be unable to attain goals by the deadline, June the 30th. Lacking aid funds, pensions are suspended, and government workers are laid off. Protesters take to the streets, and government is forced to revert to drachma to avoid social chaos. Pass the peanuts, please. End of quote. John Noonan, senior forex analyst with Thomson Reuters in Sydney, and I quote, sentiment is very bearish. The euro is under a lot of pressure right now. I get the feeling that it's going to be a nasty move lower for the euro family. End of quote. Kenneth Rogoff, a professor of economics at Harvard, quote, a Greek exit would underscore that there's no realistic long-term plan for Europe, and it would lead to a chaotic endgame for the rest of the Eurozone, end of quote. Chris Tinker of Libra Investment Services, quote, it's a binary decision. if Greece gets itself to the point where the European administration says, we can't play this game anymore, that starts a domino effect. End of quote. Nicolas Véran, a senior fellow at Bruegel, quote, France has very limited fiscal space and actually has to engage in fiscal consolidation. And finally, we have 80-year-old Greek citizen Panagiota Makri, quote, I'm confused. I feel numb and confused. Only God can save us now. End of quote. Well, all of this comes at a time when much of Europe is already going back into a new recession. Economies all over Europe are contracting, and unemployment rates are skyrocketing. Until things start improving, there's going to continue to be a lot of civil unrest across Europe. Meanwhile, things are not so great in the United States either. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon claims that the U.S. economy is holding a royal straight flush. But the only part of that he got right was the flush part. And by the way, he's got some problems of his own. Last night you may have heard, due to unfortunate derivatives plays, the company came undone to the tune of $2 billion. That's going to hurt, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to have to see how that one plays out, but Jamie Dimon is not going to be persona grata in financial circles for a while yet, I can tell you that much. Well, there are 100 million working-age Americans that do not have jobs. The middle class continues to shrink. The rising cost of food and the rising cost of gasoline are already severely stretching the budgets of millions of American families, and the federal government continues to run up gigantic amounts of debt. When Europe descends into financial chaos, the United States is not going to escape it. The financial crisis of 2008 deeply affected the entire globe. And so will the next great financial crisis. Well, just to take an email from Gilbert Persinich in relation to what we've just been talking about. Hi, Richard. I'm wondering why they color Germany as the strict austerity imposing bad guy. Is this vintage resentment due to Germany's goose-stepping past? It seems to me that Germany had a strong economy along with generous benefits for its citizenry. Now some of the EU countries want handouts with the arguments that we're all in the Union. If Germany is weaker due to its association with the European Union, how could one blame it for condoning policies that serve to maintain their normal high standards? One could argue that Germany is just backing the banks. If this is the case, then why is the conflict defined in terms of sovereign nations, such as Germany versus Spain, and not in terms of banks versus the masses that will experience a great reduction in their standard of living due to austerity measures? Why would Germany tether itself to much weaker and unregulated economies in the first place? And why don't they just leave the EU now? If you are a pearl, why wallow with the pigs? Sorry, couldn't help that one. Regards, Gilbert. Well, Gilbert, I think that Germany very well may be the first to leave the European Union. You know, people are talking about the weak countries that should be abandoning the euro at this point. But I think that Germany might preempt matters. It can't force these countries to get out of the euro. And it has to be very careful because it's being seen already as the big bully on the block. As I mentioned earlier on, they're being seen as the people who brought about the lack of democracy in Europe, and they don't want to be seen as the same people, so they may just shrug their shoulders and say, to hell with this, let's get out. Let's take ourselves, our currency and our economy, and play it on a loan basis. And I don't think that that would be a foolish thing to do, by the way, either. I think that might be a very wise decision on behalf of the people of Germany if the government did do this. Again, I don't see any certainty that it will happen, but it's more and more likely, in my opinion. Well, Gregory had a comment to make about Nigel Farage's speech, and I bring you this from him. He says, "I have watched many of Farage's speeches, and I wonder why we, the USA, can't elect even one person with such intelligence, passion, and speaking ability. He and most of the people in the British Parliament, I watch the Prime Minister's time, are far more erudite than any of our dull-witted gasbags. Perhaps it's because ours lack the proper education in logic, rhetoric, and public speaking. But then again, here in the States, it doesn't matter how intelligent our elected representatives are, because most people here are too busy watching reality TV and couldn't care even if their flabby little brains made the effort. We are a nation of physical and intellectual couch potatoes." Well, thank you very much for that piece of your wisdom there, Gregory. Very nice. I shall take it under advisement. Well, Thor Dockweiler from L.A. Says something that I didn't know in an email. He comes in, he says, "Dear Richard, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann of the U.S. House of Representatives is now a Swiss citizen. Even the zombies in Congress know the ship is sinking. Such patriotism on her part, despite having voted for several extensions of the Patriot Act. If I had my choice, I'd send the entire Congress to the watery abyss, as Catherine Hepburn did to the oil plotters after a people's trial, the defense orated by Danny Kaye in the serious film The Mad Woman of Chaillot. At least the citizens of Paris in that 1969 movie were safe after the 1789-style oubliette mimicry of the French Revolution. A rather prescient piece of cinema, a must-see in the current world for those who have not yet watched it. Cheers, Richard." Thor Dockweiler from Los Angeles. Why don't I give you the name of that movie again? Danny Kaye acting in The Mad Woman of Chaillot. So, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. A little piece of the past for your edification. Enjoy it and see how it compares with the present. All right, well, we've arrived at the halfway mark, so let's stop for a few moments, have our break, and then I'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Just a quick addendum to my comment on Monday about unemployment. One key reality which never gets discussed is that, in fact, very few workers are needed to provide the bare essentials of life to the 330 million residents of the United States of America. Let's say that bare essentials include food, heat in winter, clean water, sewage and waste disposal, public health, such as inoculations against pandemics, etc., public safety, and enough energy to fuel these essentials. If life were suddenly reduced to these basics and no energy was available for anything but these essentials, you might wonder how many full-time workers would be needed. Well, the answer is roughly 1% of the workforce raises almost all of the food in the United States. Of the official workforce of 154 million, perhaps 10% or 15 million people produce the absolute essentials of life. Now, even if we double that to include all sorts of non-essential but critical goods and services, maybe we're talking 30 million workers, roughly 10% of the population and about 12.5% of the real workforce of 240 million, Remember, the federal government has relegated roughly 88 million working-age people to the zombie status of not in the labour force to keep the unemployment official rate low. Do you know that only 7% of India's vast workforce of hundreds of millions of people gets a paycheck? The other 93% survive via barter, raising their own food, a bit of trade or occasional labor for cash, etc. And before industrialization, roughly 50% of the U.S. population and workforce lived and worked on farms. The surplus of their labor fed the other 50% who lived in urban areas. And that cash supplied the few essentials the rural dwellers needed. You see, my point here is that when nations go to war, the politicians always consider the trade-off between potential gigantic human loss to life in their own countries as against the prestige or other value of winning against the enemy. Now, the really scary part about the figures I just gave you is that America could easily wave away horrendous losses through nuclear devastation of American cities in the knowledge that very few people are actually required to maintain ongoing life afterwards. And in case you think that that's not a calculation employed by politicians at such times, I can assure you it is. Now, added to the elimination at a stroke of ongoing social and economic costs to society as a whole, things like Medicare, Medicaid, education, Social Security, national health costs, etc., these statistics offer a very seductive incentive to wage maximum war. All this, of which to say, ladies and gentlemen, another powerful reason to leave the United States. And by the way, I haven't even touched on the consequences of increased automation of the economy and consequent decrease of the overall workforce. As you know, we've had a few months of relative decline in unemployment, 200,000 people or so per month, if you believe the figures, which of course I don't. This has been accompanied by declining incomes for the median wage earner. So incomes are lower each year into the recovery than they were in the previous year, the reverse of what you would expect in a real, as opposed to a make-believe recovery. It's actually the same as what we saw in the previous so-called recovery in 2002, just a bit more pronounced version of it. In 2002 to 2007, you were able to observe the structural forces at play in that business expansion, mainly that the middle class income dropped, that very, very few jobs were created, and that the higher value-added jobs tended for the most part to be replaced by lower-paying ones. Well, those trends became pronounced in the 2009 recovery onwards. That suggests that this is a deep structural problem with the way globalization and technology is impacting the majority of the American workforce. I don't know whether this reduces America's overall growth rate. The gains of growth are so deeply skewed to the very highest earners, but there is a lot of evidence in studies of other economies that when you have gross Latin American-style inequality, growth and competitiveness tend to get adversely hit. Well, I would like to offer you a rather different interpretation of the fate of young people in America today. I don't think the younger generation is saddled with excessive government debt. Yes, of course they are in theory, but that debt, which represents the country living well beyond its means for years and consumption pulled forward, will never, ever get repaid. Now, what the younger generation does face will be an inability to borrow in order to live above its means. In other words, they will be able to afford the lifestyle they can afford and nothing more. I'm sure most would not like that, because to them it doesn't seem fair that somebody else got something for nothing, that they can't get the same. The generations that ran up massive debt, by the way, all who are just slightly above the age of consent, are equally responsible, especially since most of the debt has been rung up since the year 2000. They were lucky to be able to live better than their efforts and abilities could afford, and all because lenders lent and printed. Well, that game is over, or about to be. The luck ran out. Now, here's the part that may be difficult to digest, but which we must face up to. Nobody can justifiably complain that there are no jobs, because nobody is, in fact, owed a job by birth. It is, of course, nice if society can create an environment where jobs are plentiful, but there is no universal contract dictating that this be so. Accidents of birth landed some people in the United States at the right moment, and certain assumptive entitlements might come with that. But there never was a guarantee. Someone else, whose birth accident landed them as a female in rural India, never had any of the expectations that America's youth have. So they don't blame Indian boomers, who continue to boom at the rate of one every 3 seconds, by the way, for their lot in life. As for not being able to afford to live outside one's parents' home, wait a while. The laws of supply and demand haven't been repealed. Markets will clear one day. There is a surplus of housing stock in the United States, so eventually prices should fall to meet the purchasing power of those seeking shelter. Construction supplies can be exported, but not existing housing stock. Since housing stock is a captured asset, its price will eventually adjust to meet local demand and affordability. Now, remember, we're living in an extended period of deflation where prices are and will be coming down. U.S. housing will be a major beneficiary of this. It already exists, and since it is in surplus and not subject to the vagaries of input demand like lumber, nails, copper, etc., all of which could rise temporarily in price due to external demand, housing's price will adjust to meet what buyers can afford to pay. The boomers lived better than any one group in the history of the species. It is unlikely anyone will exceed that lifestyle in the near or mid-term future. They were lucky to be able to live above their means, but it is no one's fault that the young generation will not be able to live about its own means. The universe is being put back in balance. The dream is gone. Harsh reality takes over again. There is no complaint desk. Nobody has any choice but to deal with it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that is a philosophy that I am sure you have not heard before. But if you are to have any chance at gaining some kind of peace with what is happening and what is going to happen in the near future, you must accept those things. It's going to be impossible to fight against them. And if you do, you will only have yourselves to blame. You know, I have long since given up trying to make people see sense when it comes to an understanding of the position of different cultures as set against the world in general, or different classes within those cultures. There was a time in the past when people accepted their lot in life. It may not have been fair, and it may not have been the correct way of viewing things. But today, where everybody wants more of the same, that's not going to work any better either. So please be aware of these unfortunate but necessary facts in life, and try to come to terms with them. Well, I have an email from Neil, who writes in saying, "Richard, we all respect you so much. that I am sure that other people were just too polite to point out the inconsistency in one of your emails. I listen to every one of your shows multiple times to extract all the knowledge that I can absorb. I would seriously consider leaving the country, as you suggest, but my mother is still in Florida. Last weekend, I attended a 2.5-day conference of hundreds of people who now call themselves preppers. At one time, the MC asked for a show of hands of how many people would have attended this conference 3 years ago. Only a few hands went up. This shows the huge increase in awareness of what is transpiring in this country. These people intend to stay and protect their families by storing food, firewood, firearms, medical care, neighborhood organizations, etc. Many of the lecturers were excellent, with a few Christians thrown in for extremist views. These may have been fine after the end and not recorded. The organizers are planning to release a DVD of the whole conference for only $6. If you have any interest in seeing what's happening amongst the people who would agree with you but intend to stay here, I would be glad to send you a copy when it is available. I'm sure you don't have time, but I thought that you might want to skip through it. Well, thank you, Neil. Very interesting conference you must have attended. An email from Susan, who says, Montgomery County, Maryland is voting on a new elevated tax for people earning more than $100,000 a year. Meanwhile, the county employees enjoy generous pension benefits, and there are four different types of police within an 8-block area, all trying to harass and shake down the good citizens that pay their wages. Montgomery County Police, Tacoma Park Police, Park Police, and Prince George's County Police. Tacoma Park, for example, has declared itself a nuclear-free zone, and the city county sanctioned the Ronald Reagan when he was president, declaring itself a nuclear-free zone. Tacoma Park has a police force of a couple of dozen officers, including, of course, the chief of police. All major crimes are investigated by the county police. When property values went down, the county obliged us by increasing the tax rate. We are about to get the you-know-what taxed out of us nationwide. Regards, Susan. Yep, I rather feel you could be right there, Susan. Taxes will have to go up, and I fear that the fiscal cliff is getting closer and closer. And for those of you who have heard the cliche, ladies and gentlemen, but do not know what it is, of course, December the 31st, when the Bush cuts expire once again. Will they be renewed? We shall see. Right. Well, I thought I would read you a short story from Sarita, who many of you will know. She has contributed mightily to the show, and also, by the way, to the meetup group. Which, by the way, I should remind myself to talk to you about, because I hadn't given you my information. Don't know why, forgot. Well, never mind. This is Richard Martin. This is the wake-up call. And your toll-free number is 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. And if you want to contact me by email, please feel free to do so, rm@gfawd.com. That's RM, Richard Martin, Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, gfawd.com. And if you'd like to call me in private to discuss your personal financial affairs, please do so. My number is direct line through Sarasota, Florida, comes through to Singapore, area code 941. 441-1682. Again, 941-441-1682. And please feel free to call me anytime. And I would like to remind you, we have 1 week to go until the next meetup group, which will be in New Brunswick, New Jersey, as always. In the same place, same time, that's to say the George Street Ale House, 378 George Street, just a stone's throw from the railroad station in New Brunswick. Ladies and gentlemen, things are heating up. I cannot express this strongly enough. I urge you to go and hear what is on offer. Our moderator this time will be Jack Trevesta. Would you please be kind enough to call him to inform him that you will be attending? His number is 914-414-6940. Again, that's Jack at 914-414-6940. And he will give you information and, of course, take down your name so that you will be counted in for the restaurant at the appropriate time. That is 2 p.m. on the 20th of May, Sunday the 20th of May in New Brunswick, New Jersey. All right, let us take Sarita's story. Now, Sarita just arrived in Cuenca, in Ecuador, and she is extremely happy. She has found herself an apartment. She has emigrated. She has done it, ladies and gentlemen. If she can do it, please know that you can too. Sarita is in place, ready to start her new life. And she asked if she could relate this story, to this story rather, and she thinks I can too. And she says as follows. Recently, I got a good lesson in what it's like when your country is a target and experienced one of the biggest benefits of being part of another culture. A few days ago, I found myself walking along a quiet, tree-lined street in Positos, Montevideo, one of the city's nicest neighborhoods. I checked the address I was looking for and walked up to an attractive colonial-style home. As I approached the front gate, it glided open. A few yards further on, I reached a beautiful, old-fashioned wooden door, which also opened quietly as I approached. I thought it was a clever system, but learnt later that the receptionist inside had seen me coming and pushed a button. I turned left into what was once a sitting room in this nicely restored home. I received a warm and friendly greeting from the woman seated there and noticed the homey smell of rich, freshly brewed Colombian coffee. The lady offered me a cup and asked me to make myself comfortable in one of the nearby chairs. This may sound like I was visiting a coffee shop, but no, that's not what was going on. I'd come to the Colombian embassy in Uruguay to get some help with my Colombian residency visa. The setting may not seem like an embassy, but in fact, it's just like two other embassies I visited in this shaded neighborhood. I stated my business with the receptionist, and she said that I should discuss it with the consul directly. This was a surprise, the idea that the person in charge of the consulate would have any personal interest in my visa. But within a minute, a well-dressed woman came out and introduced herself as the consul. She asked me to bring my coffee, and we proceeded into her office, where we had a pleasant talk as she looked over my paperwork. After making a few suggestions about how to extend the life of my visa, we talked about the various neighborhoods in Medellin and how the city has improved these past few years. The experience was friendly and relaxed and altogether pleasant. The following day, I headed for the U.S. consulate to get a signature notarized. Quite a different experience. It started with my standing in the driving rain for more than 45 minutes. I knew that American citizens now require an appointment to visit most U.S. consulates, but I didn't realize that they wouldn't let you in the door to take shelter until your appointed time. So I retreated to the awning of a store down the block, where I joined a few other Americans huddled there. When my time arrived, the warm, dry guard finally let me in, where I stated my business through bulletproof glass. A young lady directed me to a security screening like those at airports. Those pocket items they didn't think I should carry inside were taken from me and stored. Next, I crossed from the security portal about 100 feet from the embassy itself, where I encountered a Marine embassy guard. Here I removed my belt and everything from my pockets again and passed through another detector. The Marine nodded to his associate in a little booth, who pushed a switch that unlocked the bomb-proof door. Inside, I waited my turn until I could shout my request to a not-so-friendly consular employee on the other side of a bulletproof window. All this security felt pointless in a non-violent, non-confrontational culture like Uruguay's. But my point isn't to criticize the American consulate for their security measures. It's likely they're warranted. Instead, my experience points out one of the hidden benefits of life abroad, of being part of another country and culture. It shows what it's like to be out of the spotlight and under the world's radar. I'm a resident of Ecuador, Uruguay, and now Colombia. As such, I'm part of countries that are neither aggressive nor the targets of aggression on the world stage. They're not occupying anyone's homeland, haven't toppled anyone's government, aren't pushing any agenda in the Middle East, and haven't taken on any of the world's religions. Whether or not these actions are beneficial to American citizens is not my point. The fact is, they'd make the United States a target. And to the point, without that target status, other countries are safer, more peaceful, and less paranoid because they have few enemies. You'll feel the difference when living abroad. You'll realize how much things like war on terror have made a difference to the mindset of the average American. Once you're removed from it, you'll realize how much tension used to permeate your everyday life, because you'll realize that it's gone. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you can make a really good start by going to the meetup group in New Brunswick, New Jersey on Sunday the 20th of May, if you wish. Anyway, thank you, Sarita, for that. A good introduction to your new life. Good luck with it all. I'm sure we wish you, all of us, the absolute very best. Okay, I got an email from Creighton Pickering, who says, "Hi, Richard. If you could give me an abbreviated answer by email, that would be good. Certainly address this on your show. Max Kaiser mentioned that he thinks we are in inflation because of the massive overprinting of the Fed. I keep hearing you shouting that we are in deflation and there is no demand. Do you see salaries rising? Of course not. Max also thought that the Dow could double because we are dealing with the dollar that will be worth half its value. Richard, do you think we should have stayed on the gold standard? It doesn't seem that if we did, this financial collapse could be avoided. One of the main problems are the derivatives that didn't exist in any way, the quantities that we created in the last decade. I may be off here. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Creighton." Well, Creighton, I did respond to you. I hope you got my email. An abbreviated response, a kind of bullet style response. I've talked about inflation very frequently, and I don't think I want to rehash that here. Suffice it to say that when things are really bad and people can't afford to buy things, to avail themselves of goods and services, it really floors my imagination to imagine that prices would go up. I don't get it. It's so obvious to me that I can't see the problem in comprehension of that. But obviously, like you ask, salaries are not rising. They won't rise. There are plenty of problems to the unemployment situation that I've talked about last Monday, and I also touched again on today, which probably answer the question of the potential rise in salaries that I don't see happening. I don't think the Dow is going to double. If in fact prices fall, prices will fall of stocks as well. I don't see why stocks would rise because the prices of goods and commodities were falling. That would probably have a deleterious effect on company earnings. Doesn't really strike me as a mandate for increased stock prices. Be careful with that one. Yes, I think we should have stayed on the gold standard. As I've always said, what Nixon did by relinquishing the dollar from the gold standard was infinitely more criminal than what he did in Watergate. But that's another interesting conundrum to be discussed one of these days. I think it's very possible that elements of the financial collapse could have been avoided. I mean, we did have collapses on the gold standard, Creighton. They are not entirely unavoidable. But I think they're going to be made much worse this time. The different collapses that we're going to see, much, much worse, much more grim and long-lasting and invasive, because indeed we are not on the gold standard. So yes, we should have stayed on the gold standard, absolutely. And any right-minded person would immediately elect Ron Paul to the presidency of the United States, because one of the things he believes in is the gold standard and the elimination of fractional reserve banking and the Fed. But apparently that's not good enough for Americans. They need to continue to avail themselves of their drug of choice, which of course is money. Derivatives, of course, are another problem that has been thrown onto the incendiary pile, which we've just seen hurting with the $2 billion loss in J.P. Morgan. Not wrong, Creighton. You've got the right idea. Keep it up. You'll have some good ideas to feed upon as time goes by. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a great pleasure talking to you as always. It is the end of another week. I wish you a wonderful weekend. I will be back with you on Monday. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.